the biggest difference between when I started practicing over 20 years ago and today is that the sheer amount of knowledge available in medical science is significant, exponentially different than before. A regulation on AI built today, in 3 months that AI looks different, and how it's used differs on who you are. So I think it's a real challenge to say we will regulate AI without saying we need a cross-industry collaborative effort to understand what the rules of engagement are. Mama, if you use AI in every single way you say in these podcasts that it can be used in healthcare, that is going to be a significant drain on the planet. You can't use AI everywhere, Mama. You have to pick where you use it. And the fact that a fifth grader can tell me that, just like the fifth graders we were talking about earlier, improved my prompt generation on generative AI. This new group of young individuals is brilliant. They're concerned about their future and they're concerned about their planet.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to Regulating AI, the podcast where we explain the intersection of artificial intelligence and regulatory frameworks to ensure fair, transparent, and democratic AI legislation. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we have Dr. Ami Bhatt with us. Dr. Bhatt is the Chief Innovation Officer at the American College of Cardiology, a renowned clinician, educator, and leader in digital health strategy. With over 20 years of experience in the field, she's been at the forefront of transforming cardiovascular care through AI and telemedicine. She previously practiced at Mass General and was an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Today, we'll be diving into the critical topic of AI regulations in healthcare, exploring the challenges, opportunities, and future directions of this rapidly evolving field. Dr. Bhatt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Bhatt, as I mentioned, we have a global audience. Our audience is made up of policymakers, think tank experts, staffers, members of EU Parliament, and obviously entrepreneurs and AI experts. So can you begin by telling them a little bit about your background and an overview of how AI is currently being utilized in the cardiovascular field?
Thank you for asking. So I began as a practicing cardiologist, boots on the ground, understanding what it's like to see patients in and out every day. And I tell people that the biggest difference between when I started practicing over 20 years ago and today is that the sheer amount of knowledge available in medical science is significant, exponentially different than before. So if I am sitting with a patient and I'm looking at them, they will have most likely an electronic health record with a lot of data. They may have some interim data themselves, wearables or other monitors that they have. They will have significant knowledge of what they are coming asking for, and then just the science for their diagnosis will be so much that in 20 minutes, despite how good a physician or nurse is looking at them, there is no way to compile all of that information and offer the best care that is scientifically available today. And I think that is what drives me to think about the importance of using AI, especially in cardiology. Now, cardiology is unique in that we have been doing big data for a very long time. We've had pacemakers in the field. We've had algorithms for care. We've had risk prediction tools. So it's also an ideal place to start using and merging from just algorithms to really intelligent algorithms, AI, and a great testing ground. Where are the areas we look at this? So one is, let's go back to that great amount of knowledge we need to harness. The advent just in the last 6 months of generative AI that is so accessible really makes us think that we need to figure out how are we going to safely enter the right information into models that can then summarize for us what we need to know when we're sitting with a patient. And so there's a role for generative AI there. I think there's also a role for AI when we think about clinical decision support. What is the right next step? How do we know But we need to set up mechanisms to regulate when we're going to use it and how we're going to follow it. And I know we'll get to that later in our chat. And then lastly, I think radiology is so far ahead of cardiology that I sometimes laugh when I say cardiology is a great place for AI, right? They've been doing this for a long time. So the machine learning, the deep neural networks, that is coming. The research is coming. I don't think we see it as readily in practice, but I think increasingly on the imaging side of the world, we do see it. And so that's how I broadly think about it. If we're talking to anybody out there who's listening, those are the areas that we're looking at. The area that's probably most in the forefront that other people talk about is also, can we streamline administrative effort? Can we improve efficiency? And that's true across any discipline. It's not limited to healthcare.
So, Dr. Bhatt, you raised several excellent points. Now, you said patients are coming in with a lot of information. It's now a much more educated patient. Now, talking to a lot of doctors on this podcast, that can be a great thing. And sometimes that can also be a little bit of a negative. Are there any negatives to that in your view?
I think the most important part when we're talking about regulating AI right now, we're thinking about how do we regulate it for the entrepreneurs, for the companies, for the platforms, for the healthcare systems, for the individual clinicians. We are not thinking about the companies who are doing generative AI that don't have any responsibility to the patient for their health, for their care. Mm-hmm. And those are the models that patients may be using today. Those are most likely the models that are most accessible. And so I think we have to do a good job of teaching our patients and understanding ourselves, what are the risks involved when we give personal health information out? What are the risks involved in taking information that's come to us that maybe hasn't been fully vetted medically? Now, it's not easy. I have a teenage daughter, and I think about how am I teaching them about social media? And the truth is they're teaching me. They're more facile, and they tell me, hey, this is risky, this is not. I'm thinking a little bit that in the doctor-patient relationship, we're going to have to do it as a partnership as well. Patients are going to tell us where they get information from. We're going to have to think together about what's reliable and what's not. I think it's much more of a partnership today than it ever was before. We really had a paternalistic or maternalistic approach to healthcare for many decades, and that's just not true today. So I think the use of AI is something we need to discuss with our patients.
But do you think there's a mind shift that needs to also happen with physicians, that the relationship is now a little bit, as you said, was paternalistic, and it's not the case? It's called the TikTokization of healthcare, because everybody gets a lot of information from TikTok or platforms like that. Do you think that kind of mind shift is necessary?
I think that mind shift started when the equivalence of Google arrived, really good search functions. So we're deep into it. I don't think that's new. Most clinicians should already have the mind shift that their patients have a partnership with them and need to be the driver of their care. If they don't, I will say they should.
So, Dr. Bhatt, you had an enormous experience in digital health and innovation. Tell us your thoughts on the need for regulating AI in the healthcare sector.
It's a big question. I'll start with just a story of how I got here, which is I take care of adults with congenital heart disease. These are kids who grew up with heart disease. They become adults. The adult cardiologist says, this is not a heart attack. You're not 70. I don't know what to do. The pediatric cardiologist says, you're 32 and you want to have a baby. This is not my field. And when I first began, we didn't really have systems for care for these patients. And so I was fortunate in being in that group of individuals who got to build everything from what the clinics look like to fellowship programs to board exams. The reason I bring that up is those are the patients who taught me about digital health. I started with telemedicine because my patients were a digitally forward population of 24-year-olds. They said, this is how the rest of the world works, and therefore we would like you to do it. And two things happened. One is, they had to accept that I didn't know exactly how to do telemedicine or digital health or digital stethoscopes or handheld ultrasound. So they were learning with me and I needed some permission from them to be learning. And my fellows learned that I didn't always have all the answers and we were doing things. And I feel the same way with AI today. We have a program at Harvard Medical School where we do mock interviews with patients and we take 16-year-olds from the Boston Public Schools and they come. And now what we're starting to do is our plan is to have them both do the mock interview and see the patient and assess what the diagnosis could be, but also use a large language model and see what the large language model would instruct them when they put in the information. So we are teaching them how to use it from the ground up. I did the same thing with fifth graders in a company called Girls Inc. that goes into inner city Worcester, Massachusetts and does this. The fifth graders were better able to generate a prompt than I was. They were correcting my prompt. So I say that before we talk about regulation, because I think we need to understand that there need to be guardrails. We need to understand what the laws of privacy are and how far HIPAA goes to protect us in AI. We need to hold everybody accountable, from the person who creates the algorithm to the one who's going to edit and iterate on it with you, to the health system who puts it in place, to the individuals who use it, including clinicians, patients, anybody on the healthcare team. But we also have to accept that it is continually changing. So a regulation on a valve made today, that valve will be the same forever. A regulation on AI built today, in 3 months, that AI looks different, and how it's used differs on who you are. So I think it's a real challenge to say we will regulate AI without saying we need a cross-industry collaborative effort to understand what the rules of engagement are. And that's the essence of what regulation needs to be, is what are the rules of engagement with these technologies, depending on where you're coming from. And I think that base is, it's important to understand that that's the base from which we're working, because these fifth graders are going to use AI much differently. And our med students are going to be able to use AI much differently. And AI will be different 6 months from now than it was before. So you can't have one regulation. You need rules of engagement. How are we all going to keep people safe while we investigate and iterate on AI?
So, Dr. Bhatt, you again have raised some incredible points. So let's talk about, we get a lot of members of Congress and Senate who come on our show. And I bring up this issue that AI is changing basically every day. How does regulation keep up with something? One of the members of Congress called it like an amoeba or something on our show. So how do you keep up with something like that? And, you know, they point to the FDA and rules and stuff like that that we've had. Do you have any suggestions for them? Because a lot of them are listening and will be listening to you. So how, I mean, they're not AI experts. They're not medical experts. So how do they keep up with all this?
So the Congressional Digital Health Caucus, we had our kind of second presentation to them last week. When I was in DC, we were talking about remote patient monitoring, and AI came up, and we had some really intelligent staffers there in the room. And one of the key topics we came across was, what can we do from a regulatory perspective to ensure that AI is used appropriately? And I think the first and foremost answer in my mind, there are a million answers. I'm going to give you one just for the sake of our show today and discussion, which is we have to have the right metrics on how we are judging the efficacy of AI. Let me take digital health as an example. Digital health companies, once FDA approved, say we engaged X number of patients. What we're pushing them to do now is to say, not only I engaged X number of patients, but how significantly did that engagement improve their health? That's what we want to know, right? What do those metrics look like? How are they being defined? For AI, we need to find that early. What is the specific pain point in medicine we're addressing with this AI? And how do we know that we addressed it? And that's what we need to demand of companies, of organizations. Now, how do you write regulation for that? Because that can vary. Well, the good news is, even though it feels like an amoeba, and I love that thought about it's going everywhere, actually, it probably buckets pretty well into administrative effort, into clinical decision support at the point of care, into assistance in interpreting, testing, imaging, blood markers, whatever it is, but assistance in interpreting, right? So we can come up with probably about six buckets that these different types of AI will fall into. And then we can regulate based on those buckets. Right. We'll need to review the regulation, see how things change based on how the technology changes. But we already know what researchers are working on. So it's not that we're looking at a technology now and we say, I don't know what will happen next. Actually, if we meet with our AI colleagues, we know what will happen next. They're already working on it. So we have to ask and we have to broaden our approach to be able to predict and change with that, or give ourselves enough leeway to be able to adjust as we move forward.
So, Dr. Budge, are you proposing that we have vertical-based regulation that is specific, let's say, in AI for healthcare? Because that's also something I brought up with a lot of our guests like you. Is that something you would propose?
There are shared use cases for AI across multiple industries. Nobody needs to recreate the wheel for those. There is something unique about healthcare AI, especially when it is going to directly affect the patient. A lot of the background AI in healthcare may eventually affect the patient, but you know, so will fiscal or educational or civic changes, right? So those are all background, and I don't think there's a need to recreate that. When we are talking about the type of AI that is going to directly influence how we are treating patients, I think that's where regulation is important. And I tell all of my clinician colleagues right now, AI is only a tool in healthcare. You are the clinician. You are making the clinical decision. You are responsible for that patient's care. You can use AI or not, but you should be able to defend when you use it. You should be able to defend eventually when you don't use it. Right? We're not there yet, but we will be there maybe in 5-10 years. But it's just a tool. And so then if we think about regulating AI as a tool, when it's used as a tool for the same purposes that it's used in other industries, take that and do it across all the industries. But yes, specifically in the vertical of making a decision based on a patient, we probably need to offer guidance in the form of regulation for that specifically.
So offer guidance, but it can be across industries. You raised a question which was brought up, and some of them asked me to ask you about data and privacy. A lot of people are worried that their data, you know, now we have a new category of business called data brokers. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they're coming up in a big way where, you know, the AI large foundation model companies need huge amounts of data. So you have these data brokers who are buying up data from different people, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a concern, whether it's the economics or the privacy, et cetera. Your thoughts on data privacy in healthcare?
So first of all, when you say data brokers, it takes me back to drug pricing and insurance and the evolution of PBMs, right? I just want to say that out loud, right? It's feeling similar. I don't know how it's different. I haven't deep dived it as much as you have.
Okay.
So I just want us to be careful in terms of the number of middle management involved in moving someone's data around. The more times you move the data, the higher risk you have that something happens. And I think we need to take ownership of that. And so I think that's really important. Now, privacy and data, let's go to my view, not representing the ACC or Harvard or MGH or anyone else, right? Which is the number of times the average human gives their data away without caring is significant. I have some friends who are absolutely kind of privacy focused, who will not give their stuff to anybody. They don't have social media. They will not ever click agree. And then I have the majority of the people I've ever met who click, yes, now let me get to that web page. Yes, on my phone, now let me buy this thing online. So, and that's true for health. The number of people who will use wearables and give away all their data and enter their data and not know where their data is even going and not have read the fine print. So sometimes when we start to say, well, healthcare data is different, people feel very different about their privacy for their healthcare data. They're actually giving away their healthcare data pretty darn regularly. And I think we just have to accept that. So that's just me as a human giving you my opinion on data privacy and what it is. Now, separately, HIPAA says, do no harm. And I am not a lawyer, but this Google versus Dinnerstein case that was back in 2017, University of Chicago, right? And I think the gist of it that I understand, and again, please correct me if I'm wrong, was the idea that the people's data who was shared to help Google create predictive mechanisms was not directly harming any of the individuals. So does HIPAA really cover that version of privacy? It doesn't. So this is more privacy than it is HIPAA, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
There's HIPAA, then there's privacy. Now take my patients who perhaps I have a voice to text in my office where I'm talking during the visit. They gave me permission to do so and it's typing up my note. So that's happening. At the same time, their phone is sitting there and we know their IP address. They may have asked some questions to ChatGPT on their phone right before they came in about kidney or hypertension, et cetera. And they may have used Google for a bunch of things. So think of how many people are technically in that room accessing the conversation that's happening to us or our prep for that conversation or what's going to happen afterwards. Who are we going to call? Where are we going to drive? Right? There are so many ways for us to be monitored and measured that I think the more important question is, are we using data to honestly make people's health better? Or are we using it to make money while saying we're making people's health better? And this comes back to my very first point, which is don't tell me you engaged with a system. Tell me how the system improved your healthcare. We have to demand metrics from these things. So my answer to you is we share data all the time. And so privacy is somewhat funny to me sometimes when that happens. That's an individual just opinion on the world. The second is privacy is extraordinarily important. And therefore, we need to understand if HIPAA is adequate or if we need different ways to keep ourselves safe in this new age where data gathering is happening everywhere. We know social determinants of health are essential. They're not fully well covered in terms of privacy. You can get social determinants on people very easily from a variety of areas. I don't think people want to share that data either. So I think HIPAA plus is necessary. And I think it's very important that privacy is addressed there. And then I think the bigger question is cybersecurity, right? The bigger question is not, am I sharing my data? It's who's going to take my data next? Yeah. And somebody's going to take my data next. It just happened to Ascension a couple weeks ago, yep. Right? And they're being very transparent about the process from what I hear. I'm not deep diving it right now. There's a lot to read about in the world. But I think cybersecurity and healthcare is the next big thing that we need to be ahead of.
Yeah.
As we are using AI, as we are thinking about regulating AI.
So you made some great points. Cybersecurity, as you know, healthcare institutions have just been hammered and held by ransomware. And as you said, our data. And one of the points you made, I think, which is a big takeaway, is that there's a need for HIPAA plus, is what you're saying, because HIPAA has been around for a long, long time. Dr. Bhatt, some of the entrepreneurs who have come on our show and who reach out to us have asked this, that how, you talk obviously about privacy and all those other things. How do you balance the need for innovation and progress and AI-enabled healthcare solutions, but also, balancing it with appropriate safeguards and oversight? Because you want the progress, and we would never get to that progress if we were holding everybody back. So it's that constant juggle. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'll give you two answers to that. So the first is, I look at my colleagues in the FDA in the US, and actually this is true in Europe as well. The tendency of regulatory bodies to be willing to push the new technologies, to have clinicians involved in the overview of that is significant. Software is a medical device. Boy, the FDA has done a great job. They're really pushing things forward, getting things through. At the same time, they are asking clinical entities like the American College of Cardiology and others to collaborate. We have a program called the TAP program where new devices and digital health that are coming through the FDA will in fact meet with us. And we'll talk about, here are the things we see. Here are the things you have to be careful about. Here are the guardrails you need. And here are the opportunities where we have real pain points and healthcare could get better if you could do this right. So I think that cross-silo interaction has to happen now more than ever. If there's an entrepreneur who hasn't talked to an engineer or IT team, who doesn't know a health system, who doesn't have clinicians, and not just a single clinician, but idea of what rural looks like, what global looks like, what big city looks like, what academic, right? So we really need, I feel, as a society, to be working closely with all of these individuals, including the entrepreneurs, to say, how can we best help you do this safely but also do it at scale. And the answer to the entrepreneurs is you cannot do it alone. And we won't see the improvement without you. And we don't want to stifle you, but we would love to help you advance and make sure you see the guardrails. I think collaboration is the answer to that question.
So collaboration, multidisciplinary skill, I think is what Dr. Bhatt, you're talking about. Dr. Bhatt, we discussed already issues of cybersecurity, privacy. Do you see any other potential risks or concerns with the use of AI in healthcare that might necessitate regulation?
I think there are two big things we're not thinking about yet. Fortunately, some people are. So the first is, let's just talk about the use of AI, right? Mm-hmm. Researchers are currently, the pure AI researchers, are currently trying to assess one very important thing with it, which is, if I never use AI, that's probably not ideal. Mm-hmm. If I always use it, and let's use clinical decision support as an example, it's the one that people understand the best. If I always use AI, that's probably not ideal. But on my team, if you look at all the people, there are situations in which one of them should use AI and probably one of them shouldn't. One of them should just be calling somebody else, right? How do we optimize the use of AI and know when we are supposed to lift the veil on here's what the AI says or here's not what the AI says? Human AI interaction is not as important in any other field as it is in healthcare. It is the most important place for us to look at human AI interaction. And there are researchers working on it. It has not reached the forefront. It is not ready for clinical implementation. And yet we need to be on top of it because that's actually how we're going to determine where AI is going to be used most effectively in healthcare. So that's on us working with AI engineers, understanding it. So I think that's number one, and that's an area where we have to work very hard. And then that will help us define regulation moving forward. Regulation will change because of our human AI interaction knowledge and testing of it. I think the second thing is we really need to talk about AI testing AI. And at some point, we probably need to have regulation that, I'll use a strong word, demands it. I hope not too many people quote that, although maybe I'm right, so then they can quote it. But the best way to know if an AI is working is to have a secondary AI on top of it right now. From my limited knowledge of the field. And so at some point, we're going to have to demand that and say, hey, have you double-checked yourself first before you come to us? This is essential. And so I think those areas are really important. If you're an entrepreneur out there listening and you're working on that, that's important. If you're on the Hill, look for that, ask for that. Let's start bringing the conversation forward. The third thing is based on my daughter, Avni. She's in fifth grade, and she is head of her Planet Protectors Club. And she reminds me, Mama, if you use AI in every single way you say in these podcasts that it can be used in healthcare, that is going to be a significant drain on the planet. You can't use AI everywhere, Mama. You have to pick where you use it. And the fact that a fifth grader can tell me that, just like the fifth graders we were talking about earlier, improved my prompt generation on generative AI, this new group of young individuals is brilliant. They're concerned about their future and they're concerned about their planet and they're being raised to think that way. So we really can't just use AI when we want to. And if there are certain types of large computing power that are using more energy than others, then we probably need to start having regulation that streamlines what we're doing, that works on computing power that is not destroying our planet. Sustainability is key.
Well, you made some excellent points. One is a human AI interface, when AI should be used and when humans should be used. And I'll come back to you on one point on that. And then, second opinion for AI giving a second opinion on AI. And the third, which is a fifth grader. Wow, I definitely feel old and obsolete. But talking about sustainability, I'm 20 minutes away from the data center capital of the world, which is in Northern Virginia, and just reams after reams after reams of data centers, and they hog a lot of power. You're absolutely right. So those are great, great points. Coming to your first point, Dr. Bhatt, I've had deans of medical schools, Berkeley, and I think even Harvard and others that have come in. And one of the questions I ask, and I want your opinion, and I can tell you what they said, is should, you went through med school. Should AI be now your curriculum? Should that be changed, keeping in mind what's going on right now? Are we training the new, as you said, the fifth graders or the people who are now coming into this class of medicine for what is today?
I want to go back to me being a cardiologist in the office for 20 years. I taught hundreds of fellows. And when they sat with me, I would always tell them, please don't memorize. Yes, you can memorize for other attendings. For me, I want you to understand physiology. Why is it this way? Work through it. Start from the beginning. I don't mind. Get a pen and paper, draw it out, and then understand what is happening. Please don't memorize, right? I feel that is no more, that is incredibly true today, right? No more true than today. Because the sheer amount of data out there is too much to memorize. So what we need to teach med students to do is, first of all, human-human interaction, right? How to be there and care for somebody. Number two is we need to teach them, how does the body work? How do all these things happen? What is the physiology? What is the biology? How does everything go? And then number three is, how do I get the data I need at the time I need it to take the best care of the patient? So yes, so far as understanding big data, understanding the use of AI is helpful in that. Absolutely. When we're thinking about how do I source the data, parse it out, understand what's relevant, translate it for this individual, and then deliver it, we need to teach them how to do that. And that is going to demand that they know how to use computing power. So in that sense, yes, they're going to have to learn about big data and AI, but I don't want to teach it to them in a classroom in an esoteric way. I want them to learn how it's actually helping them deliver care. And then for those who want to deep dive and get an additional degree, they can do all of that. But it's in that format of our next generation medical students, first of all, need to understand care of the patient and partnership with the patient in their care, right? The second thing they need to do is understand the physiology of the human body and everything that that means. And then the third is learn how to get the data at the right time for the right patient to make the best decision for their health.
Excellent. So care for the patient, be a partner to the patient, understand the physiology, and then finally the data. By the way, from the conversations with the leaders who are putting curriculum together, they say changes are in the works right now. This is the feedback I got from our guests who are deans of these schools, and they work on this stuff, which you would know better. Can we talk a little bit about health equity and AI, which is a very, very important topic that keeps coming up from members of Congress, think tanks, etc. I want to get your opinion in terms of health equity. How is that going to either enhance, AI is going to enhance that, or improve giving more equity, health equity to people? Dr. Bhatt, your thoughts?
I struggle with this daily. I think the opportunity to decrease the disparities in healthcare because of our ability to use big data, learn and glean insights, and respond back is definitely there. I don't know that the infrastructure exists in many of the areas where we want to deliver this kind of care to be able to enable it. And so one of my key goals in working with our health equity colleagues and other collaborators is, what is the existing infrastructure? And what can we do in combining digital health with AI to best allow patients to continue to live in the communities where they live and get the best healthcare possible? So infrastructure is essential. And I don't just mean broadband. I even mean digital infrastructure, platforms, caregivers, community health workers. We need to create the right infrastructure in each community. It won't all be the same for every community. It also won't be 5 million different communities. There will be themes of how can you set up a good infrastructure. And that's true globally as well. So I think there's great promise, but we need to figure out the infrastructure to use the technologies properly. Thinking differently about this idea of equity, I wonder a little bit about algorithms. I had a meeting this morning with someone and they told me that their algorithms and AI were based on largely white American populations. Mm-hmm. But that when they use it in non-white populations, it was working. I'm increasingly told that that's okay to train in a homogeneous population and then test on a heterogeneous population. I don't know enough just yet. I need to talk to my epi friends and my health equity friends. It seems not right. Why can't we just train the algorithms on a diverse population? So I want to push people at just the way I push people who are doing clinical trials and research to say, if you don't have a diverse population, please go find one. Otherwise, I'm not going to be excited if I'm, you know, on your monitoring board. I say the same to people creating algorithms. Please create it on a diverse data set. And that means diverse people. I think it's incredibly important. So this trend towards, well, we created it in this, but we think it works there, or we show it works there. Sure, you do. But by that time, you may already be out in the market. And then your incentive to be more inclusive is lower. So when you're building your models, please build the AI on diverse populations. I'm not seeing that happen as much as I'd like.
So when you mention this to companies, et cetera, and a lot of them are listening, and members of Congress are also listening, and this is a very important topic, even for this White House that we talk about. You said the infrastructure is something that is missing. What else would you like these companies to do, and how responsive have they been?
I think there are so many pressures on a young company, it's hard. When these companies, and I'm going to make some generalizations, have deep focus and don't get distracted by, hey, this is the new thing, I can do this too. Hey, this is the new thing, I can do that too. I find them to be more successful. I think we can't have a million different platforms because we won't gain insight. So not every company that has a deep ability to have insight needs to create the most user-friendly platform for that company. So I think people have to be willing to create great science and then think about how to partner, how to fit into the existing infrastructure, if there are larger people around that could buy them, grow them, or if they're going to be the platform, why? And so I think that is an important decision point that people need to make, and their boards lead them to that. When we then talk about these companies and being kind of successful at scale, I think iterative time is really important. If you are a company that can quickly work with clinicians' systems and make the tweaks and changes that are needed, that's going to be essential for adoption. And I say that very clearly and very firmly. So if you're a company that can't be agile and you're doing AI, something needs to change in the structure of how you've invested and where you're setting things up. So look at your next raise and figure out what to do. Because no AI will work out of the box in any given clinical system, period. There's no way it can unless you're putting it back in the box it just trained in. It's going to be different. There are going to be tweaks. There are going to be nuances. Everything from how the data is brought in to who the person is using the data. There are going to be things that need to change. And what I would really like to see is iterative times that are fast and companies that are agile and willing to move. I love when I see that because they're the ones who end up scaling because they can do that, because they understand. It's also a little scary for clinicians who are currently burnt out, who have a workforce shortage, to be trying new things while desperately trying to see all the patients that are lined up waiting to be seen. And so for that reason also, I think iterative time is a kind thing to do to the clinicians who are putting in the effort to help you make your AI better.
So companies need to be agile, need to be iterative. I think that's the message you're giving to some of our listeners. Dr. Bhatt, let's just go a little global. We've mainly been focused on the U.S. Should there be a global standard for AI regulations in healthcare, or is it more practical to have a region-specific regulation in your view?
I think with the regulatory world, the answer is often always the same. We need global guidelines. So for example, if you take one step back from AI to digital health, the World Heart Federation had a statement on digital health and what these pathways should look like in cardiovascular disease. Many of us refer back to that document that we authored in order to then create more local efforts. I think the same will be true for AI. We need kind of a global stance on it. The WHO will have opinions about it, so will others. The World Economic Forum is a great place to look, actually, for the way they're thinking about regulating AI and applying it in healthcare. Some of these global approaches are similar. At the end of the day, AI governance needs to be at the hyperlocal level. So like with any other regulation, you have your broad strokes, which everybody will dictate. You have the EU saying what they believe. You have the World Heart Federation. You have, you know, the UN probably recognizing risk. And I would say sustainability might be the place where they weigh in the most strongly when they eventually have to. You have the World Health Organization. But then you also have the National Academy of Medicine in the U.S. Partnering with multiple of our societies saying, can we do this together? Let's not each have a different role. Let's all put our societies together from an academic standpoint and have that together. Let's invite industry partners to also have the same document. But at the end of the day, your own particular home needs an AI governance strategy. And that has to be written and explained and edited and re-explained. And there needs to be a communication strategy with that governance strategy. If we don't communicate and we just say, here are the regulations, we'll actually not keep anybody safe.
So, Dr. Bhatt, you're saying regulations can be at a potentially global level, but governance should be hyper-local. That's an excellent point. Just sticking on global for a minute, we've had a lot of guests from, you know, we have a global audience. So we've had guests from Europe, Africa, leaders from Africa, Europe, and other parts of the world. One of the fears they come up, and I don't know if this is relevant to healthcare, is they believe that AI is dominated by Silicon Valley companies and English language will become, and the history of AI is going to be a Western society kind of a thing. So there's a big push. We've had leaders from Finland come in and they're trying to create large language models in Finnish and talking about the history. Africa has got so many dialects, etc. Does culture, retaining culture, languages play any role in healthcare at all?
Incredibly difficult and important question. As we think about developing AI, we have to recognize that we're not limited to large language models. We are thinking about machine learning, we're thinking about neural networks, and a lot of that work is being done globally in an excellent way. I think we have to recognize that cultural differences in healthcare are incredibly important. And we also have to recognize that sometimes the low and middle income countries are the ones that are able to advance new models of care delivery far faster than we can sometimes do in the regulated European Union or United States. There's a lot of learning that can happen from low and middle income countries making progress, especially with their large middle class, in digital health. And I suspect that we will start to see the same in using AI. Now, I say suspect because I think there will be a small lag in that we need the platforms and the big data systems to be well established for AI to really be effective. So now that the LMICs are establishing that, I think AI on top of that will work. I think the language is an interesting concept and it's more of a thought about English language globally in general than it is specific to healthcare, right? If we're building things out of, and when we have large language model and we're saying English words, that's important. I will tell you that the companies that I look at and think about the American College of Cardiology working with are always ones that can do things in multiple languages, that have that ability, especially when we're thinking about generative AI. If I can't ask a question in any language that I can think of, right, let's say the top 45 languages, then that's not the company I want to work with because generative AI can do it. Whether you're building it in one language or another is different, but you should be able to offer it. So there's a company that I recently worked with where you can actually just talk into your phone and ask a very specific question. And it's an enterprise LLM, so it's built with all of your own information. And they were able to do it for me in English, in Hindi, and in Spanish.
Oh.
So it's there. They're a US-based company, but they recognize this is a global economy and it's a global world when it comes to health. So when companies like that come forward and are able to do that, then the other ones who can't, I say, well, this goes back to the beginning. We are looking for equitable changes in healthcare. And if you're not based in equity when you start, you're likely not going to get there as easily later as those who thought about it in their design.
Yeah, great point. equitable basis in healthcare. Dr. Bhatt, you know, with your background in telemedicine, how can AI enhance telecardiology services? And do you see any regulatory hurdles that need to be addressed there?
The ideal world for me is one in which the majority of cardiovascular disease, which is in fact chronic disease, is managed with the patient and the clinical team at the helm in the community where people live. That's where chronic disease care needs to happen, in the home, in the community where you live. If we then see that your risk is rising, we will determine how to best care for you, whether it's in the home, in a local institution. And when you need some sort of tertiary care, intervention, major hospitalization, yes, you come to a major center, but you're getting the right care with the right person and the right team because we saw it coming. That's my model of ideal cardiovascular care. In order to get there, we need a few things. One is we need remote monitoring to be able to know what people's baseline is and when they are off their baseline. Getting a blood pressure twice a year is not good healthcare. Knowing your blood pressure the majority of every week and then knowing when you are one or two standard deviations off and being able to alert somebody to be able to provide that feedback back to you. Or if you're capable, being alerted yourself, hey, your blood pressure's up and we have a policy or procedure, an algorithm that we know works for you. By the way, there is some clinical oversight. So in order to do that kind of closed loop monitoring and put the patient in charge of their care, yes, we need AI. We need to be able to have insights on the data and then feedback loops along with education. Next, risk prediction. Can I then use your data to say you are at risk for this? I'm using these medications to lower your risk, or you are at risk for this and I should probably bring you in and have these things done. Again, for risk prediction, there's algorithmic based, but then there is advanced risk prediction, which is based in AI. So again, there's a continuum when you have data to algorithms to risk prediction to AI models, right, that will change over time. So the answer is yes. But again, I go back to infrastructure. First, we need to get everybody to get the data and the information. Then we need it to be reliably transmitted to a place. Then we need an infrastructure of who's looking at that. It's not the primary care doctor looking at every piece of data every day. That's too much. What is the system? Who's looking at it? How is feedback arriving? And then for escalation of care, how's that happening? Infrastructure is key. And then we'll be able to, once we have data infrastructure, telemedicine infrastructure, then we'll be able to use AI and really create more predictions, more loops.
Well, that's awesome. Dr. Bhatt, you mentioned the physician-patient relationship many, many times, the patient-clinician relationship many, many times. Do you think AI can strengthen that or undermine that?
I think it can absolutely strengthen it. I think the use of AI to allow clinicians to look their patient in the eye and not do a lot of the administrative work that has become part of a clinician's job is essential. So I think that's important. I also think that we don't have enough clinicians, and loneliness, you know, by my good friend and our Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, has really been highlighted as a problem that we have even worsened since COVID. So does it help to have a sympathetic AI to be able to sometimes listen and then alert when, hey, this needs actual clinical human input? Mm-hmm. Probably, especially when it comes to mental health, behavioral health, but also just to combat loneliness. So I think that's really important for our patients. And we have to figure out how to do that safely. That's the place where regulation is essential, right? That's the place where regulation is essential, because we are having somebody, something talk directly with a patient. There's a lot of studying. There's a lot of regulation that needs to happen, because you may not have the clinician directly in the middle. I tell my clinicians right now, if an AI tells you it can take care of your patient for you, just say no. We're not there yet. We will hopefully be there. And for some of these reasons, I think it's important we get there. Even the smartest person will anthropomorphize a chatbot. I sometimes am chatting with, you know, travel agency online type thing. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, that was so nice of her to ask. And then I think, no, I mean, that's not a her. That's the... Right. If I can do that, you know that every other human can do that. Where that concerns me, you said, is it going to make things worse? Where that concerns me is if that's not a regulated healthcare mechanism. And now they're saying things to a patient. A patient is trusting that over their clinician. That's where AI gets in the way. So AI is a tool for clinicians to use. It is a tool for administrative work, and it can be an adjunct to help patients. But we have to be very careful in that anthropomorphizing area of it's not a human. It's not meant to be a human, and we don't want it to be a human.
So, Dr. Bhatt, that kind of two questions related to that. You're familiar what agents are, right? These days, there's a big talk about agents, super agents. Their role in healthcare, I mean, there's people are working very feverishly on that. And there was a comment you made earlier, and I might have misheard you, that the human in the loop at least is going to be there for the next 5 to 10 years. Do you see a time when the clinician would be out of the loop, et cetera? This is just a personal forecast for our listeners to think about from an absolute expert like you.
I think it depends upon what part of healthcare we're discussing. There are interactions I have with the healthcare system where, you know, I had to make my daughter's eye doctor appointment earlier this week. And gosh, wouldn't it have been great if I could have just had some sort of a chatbot that helped me get through things, right? I didn't need a human. I had no interest in a human. I didn't want to be on hold for a human. That's just me. Maybe I'm an early adopter because of my nature and my job. But there are things where automating that makes complete sense. There are other places when it is the nuance, the edge cases, and the context that are so essential to be taken into account in decision making. And if those three things are important, especially in healthcare, although I might say that this is probably true across any arena, then you want a human in the loop, because context, nuance, and edge cases are not things that the AI of today is excellent at. Now, if you look at RAG, right, retrieval augmented generation, you can see that maybe context is increasingly becoming possible.
Yep.
Nuance and edge cases, not so much, right? So that's why I say I think it will take some time before we can take the human out of the loop. I hesitate at saying ever that the human will go out of the loop for clinical care. I don't hesitate to say that for administrative, for logistic reasons, it's probably okay to be able to start to rely more on intelligent systems.
So basically, context, emotion, I think you're saying is it's not in the near future that you will have the human in the loop. Dr. Bhatt, any thoughts about some future trends that you see in healthcare, in AI healthcare?
Yeah. I think the two big areas I'm most interested in are in thinking about human AI interaction, as we mentioned before. I'm really intrigued to see how we start to decide when AI should be used and not. It's a great area of study. And I think it will really influence how we deliver care. So I'm really looking forward to seeing where human AI interaction goes and how we can start testing it in the clinical arenas, in intelligent and well-measured, safe pilots. I think the other area that I'm increasingly thinking is important is the cybersecurity element, though. I am worried, and I think we're not taking cybersecurity seriously enough in the healthcare industry. I think we know what privacy rules are. I think we know how to build things that are safe. But when I look at cybersecurity in other arenas, they are so far ahead of us and they're still getting hacked, right? They still have problems. So healthcare just looks like a sitting duck to me right now. And I think that's because we think cybersecurity in healthcare is over there and the delivery of healthcare is over here. And until we start taking responsibility for the fact that we need to be knowledgeable and be working with these people, I think we're still going to be at risk. So I want cybersecurity to be part of the mainstream of what the healthcare delivery system is thinking about, not just that subset of people over there. And that almost takes me back to my origins. I started by doing telemedicine for young patients who, you know, they wanted me to do it. And nobody else wanted to do it with me because we didn't have infrastructure. I offered again and again. I was outpatient director until COVID happened, right? And my favorite phrase, you may have heard me say this before, Sanjay, is desperation is the mother of adoption. You know, necessity is the mother of invention. But in my case, desperation is the mother of adoption. When we need something that badly, we will adopt it. When COVID happened, we adopted telemedicine. Now that we have so much data, we need large computing power, which means we need AI. But to do that and keep people safe, we need cybersecurity to be part of our daily language, and we don't understand it well enough yet. So human AI interaction, cybersecurity, and to give a call out to my children, sustainability and making sure that we keep the planet safe for them so that they can actually use the AI for healthcare in the future.
Oh, those are great, great points. By the way, the chair of the telemedicine caucus was on our program 2 weeks ago from Congress. I wanted to just follow up on one point. You talked about cybersecurity, and I wanted your opinion because DHS folks also listen. Now, Department of Homeland Security just put together a safety institute to protect vital infrastructure. Don't you think healthcare is part of vital infrastructure in our country, in your view? Should they not be included in that?
We have
your personal opinion.
So we have one challenging word there, which is interoperability. We don't have a single healthcare infrastructure in the United States. So poor DHS people, right? So my answer is, sure, that's important. And I think we can look to countries in Europe. We can look to Canada. We can look to, you know, other places that have a great national healthcare system with a single mechanism of gaining information, putting information, delivering information back out. And I think they will lead us in thinking about cybersecurity and healthcare being vital information. So do I think healthcare information is vital? Yes. Am I speaking for myself? Yes, because I actually don't know my organization's stances on these things. We should probably establish it, or I should go learn more about it. But I think the answer is yes, but the answer is also yes. And in the United States, there are just so many platforms and so many places that healthcare data lives that don't talk to each other, that how do you do it, right?
Yeah. That is so true. That is so true. Dr. Bhatt, finally, what advice would you give to policymakers right now in Washington, in Congress, who are looking at drafting regulations for AI in healthcare? There are several bills that have been dropped, three by Senator Klobuchar on election interference. There are some others in the work. So they are listening to you. We have EU parliamentarians also listen to us. So final words from you to them.
Regulating AI really means helping create a safe infrastructure to allow AI to help us in whatever field we're discussing, in my case, healthcare, moving forward. How do you create a safe environment where these technologies can advance, can be tested, are held to standards, where we demand metrics that show an improvement in healthcare? That's what we need help with. And so the word regulation is often thought by many to be restrictive. What I'm asking for regulation to be for AI is to be the scaffolding upon which we're able to do things safely. And I think that lens helps us better understand what words to put on paper.
Fantastic. Scaffolding. Dr. Bhatt, thank you for sharing your insights and expertise with us today. Your work really in the field of digital health and AI is truly inspiring. And it's clear that careful, thoughtful regulation will be key to maximizing the benefits of AI in healthcare. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to Regulating AI. Be sure to subscribe and join us next time as we continue to explore the critical issues surrounding AI and regulation. Until next time, I'm Sanjay Puri signing off. Dr. Bhatt, this was fantastic. I took you in so many different directions, and I still have an hour and a half worth of questions pending, but we'll have you back over again. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and thank you for having this podcast. It's great to have people like you out here guiding us.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode, and leave us a 5-star review.